Hey everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the TRX Procast, your go-to podcast for all things sport performance, hosted by myself, Nathan DiRosario. In today's episode, we have a very special guest joining us, Mark Munro, the co-founder of Move HQ. Together, we're delving into the intricacies of strength and conditioning in sports, uncovering the strategies that athletes use to reach their peak performance. Throughout this episode, we'll explore the fundamental principles behind effective strength training and conditioning programs, as well as the innovative approaches utilized by top coaches and trainers. Mark Munro will provide invaluable insights into how Move HQ is revolutionizing athletic training, offering a unique environment for athletes to optimize their performance without restriction, as well as general fitness enthusiasts, which is great to see. Join us as we uncover the secrets to success in sports performance, from periodization to functional movement training, and discover how athletes across various disciplines are achieving their goals with the help of cutting and strength and conditioning methodologies. Get ready to elevate your understanding of athletic training on this episode of the TRX Procast. Enjoy the episode.
No worries. I'm Mark Munro. I'm Managing Director of Move HQ. We're currently situated in between Reading and Wokingham in Berkshire. In terms of background, pretty diverse, probably as diverse as you can get. I've worked in the health and fitness industry. I've worked for some big players in the health club kind of world, but I've worked in all manner of facilities. I've worked in education, grammar schools, state schools, private schools, both here and overseas. As a strength and conditioning practitioner, I've worked with a multitude of athletes from all sorts of sports. I've spent a lot of time in football, professional football, and I was the lead strength and conditioning coach at Queen's Park Rangers for 4 years.
And how did Move HQ come about?
Well, it came about And in all honesty, because you may see it in print elsewhere, genuinely through frustration. Having decided to leave elite sport for family reasons, but some of the guys that I work with still wanted to work with me. So the quest was to find a facility that we could work in.
Yeah.
And had the tools that met the requirements of my programming and what stage of their work they were at. And it was just really difficult. And one of the guys I was working with, Neda Manuha, I worked with him an awful lot, and we had great stuff. And then it was just always a supreme battle. And we over a coffee after a session, we were like, well, why don't we do something about it? Let's get heads together and come up with a solution where there is a facility that you can do exactly what you want to do, and it's accessible. So that's what we've done.
And I've had the pleasure of being visiting your facility a few times now, and it is world class. And the courses that we've run and some of the instructors that we've had with Hyperice as well as partners, it's just like second to none in terms of the facilities and how accessible it is. I feel that your facility, in a way, is behind closed doors in sports. You see it on social media within sports clubs, but it's not really a facility that you can go and nip in and do what you need to do apart from Move HQ. So I know you mentioned it's accessible. Is that you're thinking for it, that anyone could join, anyone could come in, doesn't need to be sport specific, but you will have access to the equipment that 90% of all sports athletes will be able to use? Yeah.
I think it's people understand now what it takes in order to get the most out of the vessel for their sport. Okay. So if we're looking at strength conditioning and sports performance, not the human body, there's a lot of resources, there's a lot of coaches out there now. I think we've got the benefit now of a couple of decades worth of sports science graduates that have come into the industry. So the knowledge is out there. So people want to replicate what they see their idols doing, you know, whether that's rugby players, footballers, badminton players, rowers. And it's always a little bit compromised when you're trying to do it at your local facility. So we do have the space here to enable people to do so. And also, it's not a scenario where you can't use this bit, you can't use this area, this is for elite athletes. I completely understand why those things do happen, but we just wanted to take down the barriers and give people the opportunity to train had a kind of dream of training without sounding too cheesy. And that's exactly what we've done.
Yeah.
So it's full of people that have just got huge ambition towards their training, whether that's for general health and fitness, sports performance, rehab, or what have you. And it is quite a unique environment down there.
Yeah, because I suppose in a way you've got a good combination of, let's say, the general public that, like you've mentioned, like just want to be like their idols or see professionals train and want to get into that type of training. But then you've also got athletes as well there on a regular basis. And I think that's a good split that you just won't see in any other gym, like you've mentioned.
It's so cool, isn't it? Everyone's just training and chatting amongst each other. And you've got mums and dads down there. You've got corporate athletes, if you will. We've got people from the local community. And they're training next to someone. They might actually go and watch tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or, who's got a race in Finland next Sunday.
Yeah.
It's like that. So it is really diverse. But the thing is, I think we're really good in the UK. I think people know what they're doing, and I don't feel as though that the industry backs people enough. So people can come here and people aren't being plonkers, they're getting on with it, and people know how to train. I'm not suggesting everyone does by any stretch of the imagination, but people know how to Olympic lift, people have got good technique on the whole when they're doing their various bits and pieces, strength training, and people have really grasped the opportunity as well to look at things like developing speed and change direction and seeing what they can do in terms of power, functional training, if you will, and all those things. And there's the space and the kit here to just go and do that and to just go and practice, because that's what it's about. It's an evolution of yourself. I'm still getting better at lifting, and I'm mid-40s now, and I would hope that anyone has that kind of frame of mind in terms of that kind of betterment. And always look into, oh, I want to be a bit better, I want to be a bit better. And that's exactly what everyone's doing here. And it's really nice to see. And it's just created such a really cool atmosphere.
And you've got a really good community as well, because anyone can come in, as you've mentioned. It's not for a lack of confidence or apprehension on, I've never really used this equipment before, I've never trained like this before. So I suppose it's also the journey from the member that you've created in terms of, this is an open facility that anyone can come. Does that, it, have you had to work on that with the general public that have around a local community, for example, that have come and looked at your facility and saw straight away, well, this is a high class facility, is potentially not for me. How's that journey? How have you worked with that local community?
It's challenging. It's human behavior. It is, you could look at it and be incredibly daunted and intimidated by what you see here, of course. And there's no way in the world I'm going to say here and sit here and say, oh, we win everyone over and everyone's really happy, because it doesn't work like that. Such is the nature of how we interact with various environments. I mean, the community is such a buzzword, isn't it? And without wishing to sound cheesy, there is a fantastic community here. It's not something that I feel that you can kind of manufacture. I think it's one of those things that just happens. But it is really awesome. And it's something that myself and Nadim are very proud of, because I think above all else, it probably sets us apart as well as the facility. But what's pleasing is the people that have contributed towards that community. They're not all full-time athletes, former professionals, and what have you, and aspiring young athletes. There are fitness enthusiasts, and people have taken that punt to come in and to this environment here. I mean, you've been here yourself, is geared up for human movement rather than sitting in a machine, plugging into a treadmill, what have you. So it does take a little bravery in order to take that step. And we've done what we can to kind of mitigate those concerns. I've made sure that all the staff that are very approachable and that they go out and they actually support people, because that doesn't always happen. And that's another whole discussion, I suppose, isn't it? But yeah, it's difficult. If I wanted to go into a yoga class now, I'd be nervous. I'm not going to lie to you. And I've done it before. So for different groups of people, different individuals, it is an intimidating environment. But I feel as though then that's where our coaching skills come in, and we try and identify that and give people the support that they need, which is the art of what we do.
So we're here to talk overall about strength and conditioning in sports. So I want to go through I suppose, the fundamental principles first and foremost that underpin effective strength and conditioning programs for athletes across sports. So, what are the key principles, in your opinion, to make effective programs for any kind of sport or various sports?
Well, I'll get my textbook out.
Yeah. I told you, like you said, it was going to be a university challenge, so.
Yeah, back at university. To be honest, I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. I think everyone knows exactly what the principles are in terms of your progressive overload and managing cycles of training and having it relative to various competitions and what have you, and deloading and all that stuff. One thing that I feel is really important is intensity. And I do feel as though nowadays it is overlooked. I think as a strength and conditioning coach, I think as a performance center, gym, I think as an organization, people want to look attractive and people want to look exciting because like, I want to be part of that. That looks awesome. What an athlete. And I see so much dross that doesn't really tick a box in terms of getting the better, getting the most, apologies, out of the person that you're working with. How am I going to develop? Well, I'm ticking a few boxes, but am I getting the correct training stimulus? And intensity is one that all too often I don't see people working at anywhere near the right levels. It looks good for Instagram, looks good for YouTube, but quite often there's nothing there. It's a nice, quick, pretty movement. It looks good. It looks good to music. But am I going to get an adaptation from that? And that's one thing that I just see so much of. And I do, when I'm mentoring my coaches, I do ask them to think about what are the things that underpin your exercise, your training prescription. Intensity has to be there. And don't get me wrong, it's not necessary to have huge high intensity for everything. We know that, but it should feature prominently rather than very rarely. And that's certainly one thing that I feel that a lot of people could do better with.
Yeah, do you think it's down to education as well from a client's point of view, but also as a coach in terms of how intense? Because I don't come necessarily from a strength and conditioning background, but when I was a personal trainer within your regular gyms, let's say, it was more you'd have a personal trainer 3 times a week. You would go through the standard, I want to lose weight or tone up. And the intensity would be something that would probably intimidate a lot of the members first and foremost. So it wouldn't necessarily be something like we're going to go from 1 to 10, the simple scale that we used to use back in the day. So, do you feel that intensity, education aside, from a coaching point of view, technique point of view, is actually the education around intensity that's lacking from the coach and the member?
I don't think that the knowledge isn't there. I think that people know exactly what they're doing. I do feel as though ultimately people need to pay the bills, people need more clients. But what you've also got to say to yourself is, well, my biggest marketing tool is actually not, okay, it is how busy I am and kind of how stuff looks, but it's also the results that I'm getting.
Yeah.
So intensity is really broad ranging. You can picture yourself on the floor, breathing out of every orifice that you've got because you've grafted so hard, metabolic off the scale. But really for me, it's what is the training focus? How do I create that adaptation? So therefore, what's my stimulus? So that intensity may be, it's relative to your one RM. It
Yeah.
might be an expression of speed, your power, your acceleration of the bar or the human body. So I don't feel as though, I mean, don't get me wrong, clients and whether that's an athlete or general public, they're there to be educated. And for me, that's always been a really important component of what I've done, whether I was personal training, working in elite sport, working with rehabilitation, it's no different. Education is buy-in, and any good strength and conditioning coach knows. So I do feel as though people understand intensity, but I
Yeah.
feel as though in order to maximize people's earning potential, they're like, right, well, how does this look to my audience now in the gym? How does this look when I put together a nice video? It's pretty boring if you're going to watch someone do five reps of a front squat
Yeah.
compared to something fancy where they're jumping up and down and rubbing their tummy and patting their head, all that sort of stuff. So I do feel as though people are educated now. Most people have, there's a lot, like I said, a lot of graduates, and there's a lot of really good other resources where people have picked up their fitness qualifications. So people should get it. I just feel as though people don't understand its importance.
Yeah, no, I agree. In terms of strength and conditioning, the programming, the methodologies, how does it differ for, let's say, endurance-based sports compared to power-based sports?
Well, there's a huge amount of similarities and a huge amount of differences. I feel as though, again, depending on the activity in terms of power-based sports, it also links to competition. Because what's my range of motion for my power-based activities at this stage? It may be that when you're looking towards a training block that is a little bit closer to the season for a track athlete or what have you, they're working in a completely different range of motion that they may well be a couple of months beforehand, when it's essentially before indoor seasons and what have you. But I feel as though, from an endurance perspective, it's again, it's that you've got all the things centering around kind of volume and what that does to the human body in terms of fatigue, in terms of restricted mobility through tightness around joints and what have you. So training's training. The human body adapts to the set of exercises that we put in front of that particular individual. So it's just manipulation of those variables. It's what's my rest time? What's my volume of work? When am I doing it? So there would be points where an endurance athlete may well be doing something similar to a power athlete and power-based activities, but at different times relative to goals of that particular training program and the competition calendar. So I didn't really give you a very good answer there.
It's good. It's all right, mate. It's
So yeah, I think there's a lot more similarities than, particularly nowadays, than what people probably give credit for.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that in terms of, like you said, the training that you see now. I think more people in all sports are getting involved in strength and conditioning than maybe back in our day when we were on the field or in the gym training ourselves. So yeah, it's a very valid point and really interesting. You mentioned briefly, you touched on it in terms of competitors getting close to an event, so on and so forth, and then before the event. So how important is periodization to the whole strength and conditioning programs?
Well, it's massive, and you're really lucky if you can plan it all out and it all goes to plan on the dates that you want it to. But the reality is that doesn't necessarily work. But yeah, you need a plan, and you work backwards. So, what's my date? What do I want to achieve? What are my objective measures? And what physical capacities and traits do I need to improve in order to compete at the highest level or get better myself? And then just work backwards. It's as simple as that. So it's really important. You have to have a plan. But I think for anyone listening that is currently studying, I think it's fascinating. And I miss academia. I think it's brilliant. But it's very different in the real world. It doesn't ever work out like you plan it. All manner of things can pop up to interrupt that, super macro cycle that you put together. But we need that plan. But that plan, we need to be able to adjust. We need to be able to modify, and we need contingency plans. But yeah, it's so important. We need to know what we're doing this week, next week, next month. Where's the competitions come in? What does that mean for my training? Okay, well, now I'm focusing on this. This underpins my next period of training. So from a scientific perspective, we have our periods of training and they all complement each other. And then we dedicate time towards working on those particular things in the lead up to whatever it is that we're focusing on in prime competition time. And if it's a singular event, that's fairly straightforward. But, for those that play team sports, it's much harder.
Yeah, it's kind of a week in, week out, isn't it? I suppose for the single event, your ideal timing for the periodization, how long in duration would you get someone through the door, say at Move HQ, to where the event is? Do you like to work on a specific time, say like 12 months, or can you do it short and sweet over 3 months? What's your general sweet spot, I suppose, for the timings?
You want to work with an athlete for the longevity of their career.
Yeah.
I don't feel as though you could put a time on it because ultimately, like I said earlier, you're ultimately trying to make someone a better athlete all round. And a lot of that is skill acquisition. People become better at Olympic lifting, their technique will improve. You're always looking for that with everything you do. If it's a split squat, if it's a pull-up, some fancy shoulder press. You always want your athletes to become technically more competent, and that journey takes years. So there isn't those that are fortunate to work with national squads have Olympic cycles, and they'll work with a group of athletes for 4 years. And that's a fantastic amount of time to work with someone. It depends on who you're working with, depends on, exercise history. An exercise history is applicable to an elite athlete as it is to someone from the general public. What have they done? What are their competencies? Who have they been working with? What have they been doing? And unfortunately, sometimes you'll find that people have developed poor patterns, poor movement patterns, ways of looking at things by working with people that could have potentially been a lot better. You're
Yeah.
working with people that have got injuries and various bits and pieces. So, maybe you want to work longer with them. There's no kind of sweet spot in terms of the amount of time, but the longer the better.
Yeah.
But that doesn't suggest that you can't make a difference with someone in a short period of time, of course. And quite often that is the case. People want to reach their optimal performance for a half marathon, or they want to get back fit so they're available to be signed in a transfer window for football.
Yeah.
Or maybe that there's an opportunity to go and get scouted regional, rugby union. So, yeah, it's just as varied as everything, and that does seem to be my answer for everything, but the longer the better with that, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the functional training and functional movement, to enhance athletic performance but also reduce the risk of injury. What kind of role does the functional movement play in both areas to enhance performance, but also to reduce the risk of injury?
I mean, that's very much interlinked to intensity, isn't it? Functional training is a term that made a lot of strength and conditioning coaches screw their face up a few years ago. However, it's a really good descriptor, isn't it? It does it you do get pictures in your head of quite dynamic movements and what have you. It is important. I think it really does play a role. And I don't feel as though there needs to be, right, well, this is my strength training and this is my functional training. I think it's a scale, and you've got, very simple compound movements potentially on one side, and then you've got something, things that I was talking about earlier that are potentially a lot fancier. And again, it's our skill as a strength and conditioning coach or personal trainer is to think about, right, well, what's the evolution of the person that I'm working with? What is their skill set? What do I believe they should box off before they go into some of these other things? Or is my ethos that actually I'm going to go all over the place to
Yeah.
challenge me, which is another really valid approach. In terms of injury prevention, I think it's important, and it's getting the balance right again. There's a lot of people that sit in the strength camp. I've seen a lot of videos out lately, actually, that have been controversial. You'll get those big American guys that say, ooh, if you can't squat or deadlift this, then you're not doing this. Mitigating the risk of injury is a massive one, and that is as important as facilitating performance, because it's no good if you can't work with your athlete because they're injured. So mitigating the risk of injury is huge, and functional movements go a long way towards kind of developing that kind of robustness. They're dynamic in nature. You've got different different ranges of motion. You might have a combination of those. You've got elements of instability. So they're really key, but they're also key from a priming perspective as well. So I feel as though they do hold as much value as pure traditional strength training movements, if I'm honest.
Yeah. And do you feel that injury prevention and recovery has got more, let's say, important over the years when you first started as an S&C to now, purely because, you know, companies like High Price, for example, companies like us, like TRX, are really showcasing recovery products, recovery movements on our piece of equipment? Have you found that kind of balance shift over the last few years?
It's always been there in elite sport.
Yeah.
From my experience working in professional football, for example, and you speak to anyone who's had a similar role when you're working with first teams and what have you, you know, you do well if you can develop any of your players' strength and power and what have you, particularly those that are playing week in, week out. So really, it's how do I make my group available for every training session and every match? That's really your remit. I think when you're working at top-end sport, particularly with those team sports where they're competing at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, it's not realistic to make any meaningful gains in performance. Love someone to prove me wrong. People that play week in, week out, you want to, because that's what you have a passion about doing.
Yeah.
And I always wanted my guys to get more athletic, more powerful, quicker, stronger. But again, it all depends on your sport. It all depends on the group that you're working with, because a lot of that can be achieved through that competency we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Some sports have a poor uptake and, you know, poor ethos or inconsistent ethos around strength and conditioning. Football is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
So you're taking the opportunity to teach people those skills, and they'll get a stimulus from that straight away, even at a lower intensity that's going to benefit them. I feel as though, you know, there's a lot to be gained with that.
Absolutely. And what strategies do you address in terms of the unique needs of athletes at different stages of development? So, for example, from youth to elite athletes, how's that like strategy kind of differ? It's obviously not the same. Well, it could be the same exercises, could be the same kind of intensity, let's say, but there's got to be some differences between when you first starting out as a youth to then your peak performance on the field.
It's something I'm really passionate about, to be completely honest with you. Anyone that knows me will testify to that. Athletic development's key, and I feel as though it's an area that I say in the UK that we can get for the betterment of what we produce, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. Is it different? It doesn't have to be. It all, again, depends on who you're working with. You know, if you look, there's a lot of models out there, long-term athletic development models, and I feel as though there's a lot more buy-in now from parents because people understand it. And this goes back to the fact that there are so many graduates with sports science degrees, strength and conditioning degrees out there now that want to use their skills and make a difference, and they identify that. So the provision of that has increased. The education is massively important alongside that. And it is far more commonplace. So to have a framework in place throughout a child's development is really important. I am a big advocate of Rodri Lloyd's work. I always reference his research for everything that I deliver and we deliver here at Move HQ. But to have it goes back to having a plan and those windows of opportunity okay, so what can we kind of look at this year, if you like? And there's all those factors that we need to consider, aside from chronological age, is, you know, maturation and what have you. And they're super valuable. I just feel as though it would be really nice if it could be, if it could come from schools as well. I know it's massively unrealistic, but if PE could be a bit more upskilled and it could be more aligned to long-term athletic development. And I feel as though there's a lot of teachers out there that do a really good job.
Yeah.
But Yeah, so you know, from the primary school ages, because it's that's something that doesn't necessarily happen as much as what it should do. But there is essentially nothing different, you know, or it's just a journey. It's skill acquisition for me is of paramount importance. And if we're ticking, you know, those areas where we can really take advantage of neuroplasticity, for example, with a young athlete, that's key. That's absolutely key. And then they can take those skills with them through, you know, adolescence and through to adulthood. But there's no reason in terms of intensity that, you know, my 10-year-old athlete can't squat at 90% intensity like my full-time athlete who 4 days later is going to go and play in the Premier League. There's no, you know, in that respect, that there is no difference. But would be nice to see. It would be nice to see more of the right things being done in that kind of prep school, primary school age, because, and again, it's a can of worms, this is a separate podcast. It's
Yeah,
because
definitely.
kids don't play anymore.
No.
Kids don't play anymore. And they're genuinely a can of worms. That's a, like 2 hour conversation, which is why what we do is even more important, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think we will get you on another podcast to open up that can for sure. Because it's a very important subject, but also a touchy subject I find with a lot of people. So yeah, it's a very interesting topic. In terms of the advancements of sports science and technology, how has that influenced the evolution of strength and conditioning over the, you know, modern sports training today? How has that advanced? Has it advanced it? Has it made it more difficult in a lot of ways? What's your opinion on the advancement, but also the technology that's been integrated?
Yeah, our technology is fantastic, isn't it? Not all of it, but most of it. Well, it informs your prescription because you get to work with objective data. I think that's really key when we're trying to prescribe a program exercise is, well, has this made a difference? Where am I trying to get to? It's all down to your goal setting, isn't it? It's
Yeah.
about the ability to confidently and accurately measure outputs and performance. But technology is, you know, it's not just about exercise prescription, it's about monitoring your athletes, your individuals, you know, particularly if we've got to consider what their training schedule is like over the next week or two. So technology's been massively useful in terms of informing us about the state of the people that we're working with. Technology also in terms of recovery, I think that's been a game changer.
Yeah.
I think that's been really advantageous from elite sport performance through to general recreational health and fitness because people now understand the concept of recovery and what that means for your next training session or your next competition. If I recover properly, you know, I know that I feel better, so therefore I should be able to perform better. So that tech's been great. I mean, you mentioned Hyperice; those guys are fantastic, and we have a lot of their kit here:
Yeah.
massage guns, vibrating balls, foam rollers, leg compression stuff. And these, you know, particularly with a lot of the compression stuff have been around in professional sport for a while, but they're really accessible. You know, we can get a lot of benefit from priming, from recovery, from just grabbing something. We don't need a member of staff and a bed and a spare half an hour. I'm
Yeah.
not suggesting it's the same at all because I don't think there's any comparison. Having a dedicated soft tissue therapist with good hands that knows what they're doing is absolutely golden. But this, you know, you can take it home. You speak to any professional footballer, they've got stuff at home, professional rugby
Yeah.
player. So it, you know, it's something that is easier for them to do, you know, one day post competition and what have you. So technology is fantastic, and you know, I think also when you go to prescription, people aren't taking around bits of paper around the gym anymore. People have got better means of, you know, jotting down and keeping tabs about what their training is and how they're getting better. And, you know, we've got the means now to, you know, have a look at that information and feedback to kind of fuel that behavior, hopefully. And like I said, inform the athlete and individual and ourselves.
Yeah, as would you say data then in terms of technology and how quickly you can get data has made your job as an S&C coach a lot easier in many ways?
Yeah, I think so. If you've got defined goals, I think that objective data is really important. I don't feel as though it's always necessary. It's not necessary with everyone. Again, comes back to who you're working with. But having the information at your fingertips is, as a coach, it reinforces the fact that the intervention that you've put in place is working or it's not. So therefore, what was the process? What needs to change? But the biggest thing is that kind of behavioral aspect from the athlete, the individual you're working with, and seeing something that's not subjective, you can't argue with that. And that really is hugely beneficial for that person's motivation, etc. And it's something that they can use to make the whole process overwhelmingly positive.
And in terms of the programming itself, and as you've mentioned, there are fundamentals that go across strength and conditioning programs across all sports, but it also has to be, I suppose, hyper-personalized in a lot of ways. At the start of the journey with your athletes, is there anything that you will do for every single person in terms of getting to know who that person is, testing them? Is there things that you would do with every athlete, no matter what sport, where they're at currently, to start with before, I suppose, you tailor it to be a bit more personalized and specific to their training needs?
I think any good coach will make sure that fundamentals of strength training and movement are there from a general perspective before they get a bit too specific with it. So I feel that's important. I'll quite often box off certain movements. Can my athlete hinge? Can my athlete squat? What's my athlete's balance like? What's their range of motion like around various joints? Can they push and pull effectively? Can they rotate? Can they anti-rotate? So they're important to tackle, I think, early doors, so you can see where you're going to go with your prescription. But the most important thing is, for me, is building that relationship, is building that buy-in. That's always something I think I've probably had a strength in. I think every coach has different strengths in certain aspects of what they do. But you could have the most fantastic program in the universe, but if you don't get athlete buy-in, you're not going to get close to what you could feasibly achieve. So that's really important to me, is getting to know who I'm working with, trying to find those emotions that trigger them. But also, as well as aside from what motivates them, is to try and ask your probing questions and your testing questions to see, what areas might be to the detriment of this individual's buy-in, this individual's state of mind when they leave you, et cetera, et cetera. Can they cook? What's their home life like? Because, you might spend, a couple of hours with someone a week, 3 hours with someone. That leaves a lot of hours while they're on their own. So if you can start to develop that relationship, then you can look at altering or molding those behaviors that they will have away from their time with you, which is massively important, all those other pieces of the puzzle. So for me, that's something that's really important to me.
Do you feel it's more important than the actual programming itself? Because if they, like you say, if they've
No,
got
of course not. Of course not.
in what way?
In what way?
Yeah,
I
so
mean,
for example, if they've got you've designed the S&C program for an athlete, right? And they were following it to a T, but they've got stuff outside of, like you say, the gym, the facility, where it's affecting their performance in training. So that's the reason I asked. Do you feel that the support outside of the programming is of more importance in some ways? Not necessarily important completely, but
okay. I mean, it's massively important, and I suppose I did suggest it is more important, but you've got to get your programming right. But without that, then like you said, whether they're gonna apply themselves to their training program, if they're going to have enough frequency or whatever, it is massively dictated by that. I always say, and it's very applicable to various scenarios, that the most important muscle in the human body is the brain. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, your personal relationship with who you're working with affects what goes on there, and therefore affects what's happening in your skeletal system and your musculoskeletal system and the outputs that you produce.
Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. And do you, have you had to find, had to educate yourself more on mental healthness and wellness, sorry, because again, it's getting more and more popular in a good way because people are recognising it more. Is that something that you've had to learn a little bit yourselves, or was that something of interest to you, or are you finding that athletes are a lot more open around mental health now because of the education that's available?
I think in society, people are more open about it now. That's another podcast. We've got two lined up now.
Yeah,
it's really important. And it is really nice that people can talk about it. From a personal perspective, once you leave the lecture rooms and you've done all your work and you start to go and practice, you know, you do carry that appetite and that thirst for knowledge. And, you know, you read your journals and you read your books. From a behavioural point of view, mental health point of view, I don't think you can read stuff and just kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
You'll hear a lot of old men like me say there is a bad experience, and it really is. I think, you know, throughout people's lives, if you're self-aware and you know, you listen and you look, you learn a hell of a lot. And if you're cognizant of what is actually happening around you and you try and consolidate that by listening to other people's opinions, and it may be that you'll read something, then you do learn how to deal with people and deal with situations. And we all go through stuff ourselves as well, you know, and you learn from that. And I think when you have an understanding of psychology, you know, whether it's underpinned from your knowledge of exercise or sports psychology, you start to kind of, you're conscious about, you know, what is actually going on in your head. And then you have conversations with athletes, with friends, and you see what's happening. And there are patterns, you know, but it's a super important area. And I feel as though with the experience that I've gained now, I can be confident to ask leading questions if I feel as though someone wants to say something. But I can't, as you alluded to, though, now, I think nowadays mental health is something that doesn't have a stigma about it, and people are prepared to talk about it. I still feel as though men aren't the best. I think females are better at that. That comes down to the whole alpha ego thing. But I think guys are loads better than what they would have been like when I was growing up. And that's really encouraging, because if people just talk and you get the right pair of ears listening to you, it can make a massive difference to your training and your life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more there, Mark. And that's, but in a way, well, not in a way, you've had to deal with mental health over the years of sport, especially because I would assume anyway, coming up to 2 weeks, 1 week before the event, that necessarily that stress, that anxiety starts kicking in a little bit more. Have you found that over the years anyway? Is that generally what happens, or do you find that most people, because they're planning well, doesn't really matter, it's not going to change their approach or how they're mentally prepared for that particular event or particular sport?
Well, again, it's the evolution. When you work with people that have been there and done that, they've got their coping mechanisms, they've got their routines. So it's, you know, it's something that they're used to dealing with, and they channel those anxieties in the appropriate manner. But yeah, you know, people get apprehensive about things that are going on, upcoming competition, matches, a race, something's not feeling right. And it is how we deal with those things. It's having the right people around you to give you honest but supportive kind of feedback. And as I said, it's, as an athlete, you, part of your development as an athlete, whether it is a high jumper, whether you're playing ice hockey or what have you, or ping pong, you develop those, they're skills, aren't they? There's so many skills, whether it's my ability to jump higher than everyone else in the room. Well, actually, I can also process this information more, so I can actually go to my next training session. I can show up and give it 100%.
Yeah.
And then next Tuesday, when I'm competing at 9 o'clock at night, which I'm not used to, actually, I've been here before, I can do it. And that's part of that whole developmental process. And everyone has very different things, because we're humans, we're all super different.
Yeah.
So you'd be in a changing room, professional footballers. Some guys before a big match will be dead quiet. Some people will be talking to loads of people to distract themselves. Some people will be listening to music. I've been in changing rooms where, players always make themselves sick before they go out and play because they get
Really?
nervous.
Wow.
Yeah. So you get your pre-performance routines, but then it's how you manage anxiety. And what you go through, right? I've been here before. I'm going to go and wet my boots. I'm going to go and tape this. I'm going to go and talk to the kit man. Whatever it is. So it's no different to me or you going into a really important meeting.
Yeah.
With someone that it's business critical. That's something I'm learning. I'm probably better in a dressing room. But anyway, so yeah, it's just human behavior, and it is super fascinating. And it is something that changes in all those different environments with experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any particular subjects? I know that you're well into your education and you're always looking to study and learn more. Is there any particular subjects that you're quite interested in right now that you're reading on or just observing from the outside?
Honest answer is no. I think I've spent. It's really scary when you start looking at things and you start thinking, oh yeah, I've spent the last 10 years. Oh no, it's the last 15. Oh no, it's the last 20. As you
Yeah.
get older, it's a nice problem to have. I'm now a business owner, so I would love to have nothing, with the utmost respect, to do than go and sit down and really immerse myself in, some literature. I'll be honest, I've got Kelly Starlett's Subtle Leopard book sitting at home, and I keep wanting to read it, but I'm just too busy because I'm
Yeah.
learning how to be a businessman
Yeah.
and trying to be a successful businessman. And whereas I've mentored young athletes and the odd coach here and there, I've got a team of strength and conditioning coaches now. And what I'm trying to think of is like, well, how can I mentor these guys, so that they can have a really good stepping stone on their journey towards wherever they're going to end up with strength and conditioning. But then, so what are we doing next month? What's the marketing? What's the plan? What clubs have I got coming in next season? What's my, waiting list for rehab? So there isn't an area. I'm just trying to spin as many dishes as possible at the moment and keep them all up in the air.
Well, you're doing all right, and you can keep up the good
Good.
work for sure. How's that transition gone then for you from a full-time S&C coach to a full-time business person?
Yeah, it's as an industry, I'm not alone in this. There's so many of us that have been fortunate enough or motivated enough, driven enough to actually start up their own venture, whether that's doing something in the park, doing something at the local village hall, up to the scale of what we're doing here. And it's not easy, I'm not going to lie. And I'll often, fine. I walk around the gym tidying up more than my staff at the moment because that's
Yeah.
just what I've always been used to, and that's never going to leave me. I'll go up and help someone when I see them, doing an RDL, or they could be doing a bit better and stuff like that. There's a lot to learn, but I'm excited by that. I'm not going to lie and say that it doesn't come with any stresses or anxieties because it does, and
Yeah.
I think you're very lucky if those don't exist when you're running a business, and I would challenge you to suggest that they probably should be there. But it's been interesting. I think I've learned a lot, and a lot of those things have been applicable to a lot of stuff I see around me now. Because most of us, we're coaches, employees, and you never need to know what goes on essentially behind the scenes. But yeah, it's been a really steep learning curve, and I've got a lot of things wrong, but I've got a hell of a lot of it right, and that's a testament to what's going on in the gym behind me at the moment, you know, and, which is fantastic. But it's been a journey, but I'm only partway there.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Like I say, like you keep up the good work because the facility is fantastic. Your team's fantastic. You know, everything about the facility is fantastic. So yeah, keep up the good work. Is there any parts of being a business owner that you actually enjoy more than any others? All of it you've got to do anyway, haven't you? But is there any particular parts that you like?
I do enjoy like loads of it. I like enjoy loads of it. Sometimes, you know, I train in the facility. A lot of business owners, a lot of people in senior positions will quite often train somewhere else. That's not exclusive, but it does tend to happen. I like training downstairs. People talk to me. It can be a bit distracting at times. But then I'll sit there sometimes and I'll think, wow, all these people are here because of, you know, an idea that we've had and that we've executed. And these guys are coming in here, they're getting ready for the Commonwealth Games. This guy's coming back from ACL reconstruction. These guys are really enjoying their training. These guys are making friends with each other. That's so cool. And yeah, that kind of fans the flames and keeps you going when you have more challenging, arduous, boring things to do, like invoicing and HR stuff and all that stuff. So
Absolutely.
that's nice. And just you know, talking to people are so overwhelmingly positive about what we've created here, and that's really nice because this place, Move HQ, was created out of frustration, but also ambition. And people are really grateful that we've done it. They love it. Like, they love it. And I still tour people around the facility that work in professional sports, and people smile, people's jaw drop, and it's awesome. So, yeah, I like that. I like sharing the world that we've created here with other people, and also seeing people flourish here, which is super.
Mark, thanks a lot for your time. It's been a brilliant
Oh,
conversation.
pleasure.
Listeners, fully, I'm sure they'll fully enjoy that. Really appreciate it.
That's all right, mate. No, it's good.
Thank you for joining us on this insightful episode of the TRX Procast. We hope you found our exploration of strength and conditioning in sports both informative and inspiring. Special thanks to our guest, Mark Munro, for sharing his expertise and shedding light on the innovative work being done at Move HQ. As you continue your journey in sports performance, remember the importance of dedication, discipline, and smart training. Whether you're an athlete striving for excellence or a fitness enthusiast seeking to improve, the principles discussed today can guide you towards your goals. Be sure to follow the TRX Procast for more engaging conversations with industry experts and athletes. If you have any questions, feedback, or topic suggestions, don't hesitate to reach out. I'd love to hear from you all. Until next time, keep pushing your limits, embracing challenges, and pursuing your passion for sports and fitness. This is Nathan DiRosario signing off, wishing you all the best on your journey to greatness.